Well, I'm told that now we have with us on the telephone our scheduled guest for this hour of Focus 580, Tariq Ali. Let me tell you a little bit about him. He is perhaps one of Britain's best-known thinkers on the left side of the political spectrum. In fact, just recently he was named by a British publication one of the top 100 public intellectuals in Britain. He is a writer, a journalist, also a filmmaker. He was born in Pakistan, in Lahore, in 1943. I guess that time, actually, it wasn't Pakistan yet. He was educated at Oxford, where he became involved in student politics, particularly with the movement against the war in Vietnam. After that, he owned his own independent television production company, which produced programs for Channel 4 in the UK. That was during the 1980s. He's a regular broadcaster on BBC Radio, also contributes articles and journalism to magazines and newspapers, including The Guardian and the London Review of Books. He is editorial director of London publishers Verso and is on the board of the New Left Review, where he's also an editor. In addition, he has written a number of novels. He's the author of a series of historical novels about Islam. Those books are Shadows of the Pomegranate Tree, The Book of Saladin and the Stone Woman, and also has written nonfiction, including the book 1968, Marching in the Streets, which is a social history of the 1960s. A new book of essays titled The Clash of Fundamentalisms was published in 2002. He is visiting the campus of the University of Illinois. We'll be giving a couple of talks that are open to anybody who's interested in attending. Today, the 19th, he'll be talking part of a panel on the subject, The Future of Radical Politics, and that will be this afternoon at 4 at the Humanities Lecture Hall at the IPRH building. That's on 804 West Pennsylvania. Illinois Program for Research in the Humanities. I believe that's what that stands for. Also, he'll be giving a talk in the MillerCom series, and that will be on Thursday, 4 o'clock in the afternoon, talking about Iraq. And those, of course, are always open to the public. Anybody who is welcome to attend, anybody who's interested, certainly should feel welcome. Questions on the program, too, are welcome. 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana, where we are. We do also have a toll-free line, and that is good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. So at any point here, if folks are interested in participating, they should pick up the telephone and call us. Mr. Ali, hello.
Hi.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us.
Very good to be with you.
We certainly appreciated you giving some of your time. There are so many things that I would be interested in going into, but I guess perhaps it's the question is motivated by the fact that I know that you have written these novels that have as part of their theme the clash, provided that's an appropriate word, between Islam and Christianity, and that people, as they talk about what's happened here in the last couple of years with what has come to be called the war on terror, the American response, still characterize it as being that same sort of thing, that clash of civilizations, maybe what you have called in your book the clash of fundamentalisms. And so maybe we can start there. What do you make of all of that? And do you think, in fact, that people are really seeing this as it is?
Well, I think there's a big difference with the past, of which I write about in my fiction. I mean, the fiction project is essentially a set of 5 novels, of which 3 have been published. The 4th I finished this summer and should be published next year, showing the clashes which took place on the borderlands between Western Christendom and Islamic civilization. That was a very different time because Islam was then at its peak. It was recognized as the height of European Mediterranean civilization, and it dominated that part of the world. Today we're in a very different situation. And that's why I characterize it not so much as a clash between Christian and Islamic civilizations, but really as a clash between an imperial fundamentalism, which is embodied in this particular administration which you have at the moment in the United States, and various religious fundamentalist groups in the Islamic world. But it's a very uneven clash, in my opinion, because on the one side you have the world's largest power, with advanced military technology, which no one can match or defeat or even come close to competing with. And on the other side, you have at the maximum 3,000 or 4,000 guys who are essentially a pinprick. So for me, the war against terror, as it's described, is not a serious business at all. It's not like the Cold War, when the enemies of the United States, or perceived enemies of the United States, or the Soviet Union, and China, that whole communist bloc. There is no way in which these guys can be even compared to that. So I think this is largely an ideological construct designed basically to pursue the needs of the United States government at the present moment and the American empire. That is essentially what's going on. Because, I mean, if you look at it seriously, the real threat, economic threat, not military, the economic challenge to the United States is not going to come from a handful of Islamic fundamentalists, but is really comes from countries like China, Japan, the possible unified Korean Peninsula, and maybe even the European Union. These are the economic rivals, because the whole world is now capitalist. So these are the people who might threaten U.S. economic strength and hegemony, and in fact are doing so. So the so-called war against terror is really a substitute.
Let me go right to the issue of Iraq and what it is the United States says that it is doing. The administration has made the case that they believe that it's in the interest of people in the region, it's in the interest of the world to promote democracy in that region, which is what the United States says it thinks that it's doing. And that its idea is that what has happened is that a despotic regime has been replaced with now admittedly a time of great uncertainty, but that the end goal is the is to have a free and democratic Iraq. And the idea there is that then once there is a beachhead established for democracy, that it would spread out from there. And I know that you've been very critical of that idea, and that you don't really believe that what the United States have done really is going to lead in that direction. Let's talk about that.
Well, in my latest book, Bush in Babylon, The Recolonization of Iraq, which is just out in a paperback edition and updated, I try and explain what the United States is really up to in that region. It's got very little to do with democracy. It's got a great deal to do with establishing U.S. hegemony in large parts of the world, and this, in particular, in an oil-rich country with the second largest reserves of cheap oil just lying underneath the ground. I mean, the notion that the reason for the intervention has anything to do with democracy, I find totally grotesque. I mean, the United States, and prior to it, the British, never showed any interest in having democracy in oil-rich countries because they prefer to deal with oligarchies, they prefer to deal with dictators who can keep control of that country and keep the oil flowing. I mean, why was this democracy not considered suitable for Saudi Arabia, which has been an ally of the United States since the Second World War, or Egypt, which has been an ally of the United States since the late 70s, why this sudden love of democracy just at this precise moment? Why did they not think about democracy when Saddam Hussein was a close ally of the West? In fact, if you study the situation closely, it's when Saddam Hussein was closely allied to the West, very close to the United States, that he committed some of his worst crimes against his own people. Subsequently, these declined, and over the last 5 years, very little happened on that front. But this is why no one in the Arab world takes the United States seriously. First, they said he had to be taken out because he had weapons of mass destruction. This was a lie. But even if it hadn't been a lie, lots of people in that world said, well, the only country which we all know has weapons of mass destruction is Israel. You don't do anything about that, and yet you attack an Arab state. But that, in any case, was not the truth. Then they said, both Bush and Rumsfeld said that he had links to 9/11 and Al-Qaeda. No one else anywhere in the world believed this for a minute, because Saddam Hussein was a secular nationalist leader, hated the religious groups, and had crushed them. So no one else believed this. But in the United States, when Bush and his administration said it, a large majority of the American population believed it. Now that figure is down to 37%. So they gave these two key reasons for invading Iraq. Democracy wasn't mentioned at all in the early days. to try and convince the skeptical public to go to war. Then they went to war. We now know there were no weapons of mass destruction, no links with Al-Qaeda. So now they've saying, oh, well, we've got to be, it's good anyway, because we're going to give them democracy. Well, democracy is never given to a people. People fight for it themselves and gain it and get it. And a democracy which is imposed from the top very rarely works.
Do you think that there is any possibility then that, nobody expects this to happen immediately, that in the long run, there will be democracy, it will be true democracy, it will organize from the bottom, and that it's at some point, as some people say, whether it's 10 years, 20 years, 50 years from now, we would look back on it and said that while mistakes were made, the end result is positive, and it's what some people thought would happen or could happen.
Well, no, I don't think so, actually. I think you could have democracy in Iraq very rapidly. You don't need to wait that long. But what would happen is you would very rapidly get governments which would demand two things immediately. Any elected government in Iraq, Iraqi control of Iraqi oil, and the withdrawal of all foreign troops and no military bases in Iraq. So what would the United States do with a democracy which wanted that? When the Iranians tried that democracy in the 50s, the CIA and the British organized to topple the democratic regimes. The record of the West in bringing democracy to the East is not a good one.
Is there any? Can you find any respect in which you would say that that Iraq is better off now that Saddam Hussein is gone?
No, I really don't believe that it is. I mean, if you look at the country, it's in total chaos. The figures of civilians killed vary. The lowest figure you get is 11,500 Iraqi civilians dead. The highest figure you get from NGOs and human rights organizations is 36,000 civilians killed. There is a total breakdown and collapse of law and order all over the country. You have the torture in Abu Ghraib prison, which has completely antagonized and alienated not just the population of Iraq, but large parts of the world. So to claim that Iraq is better off under a foreign military occupation is not believed by the population. And, you know, you do vox pops there. No one sort of particularly misses Saddam Hussein, but no one will tell you that the situation now is better.
Well, let's, if we could wind the clock back to the point just after September 11th and look at the things that the United States has done since, what would do you think would have been a more productive strategy that might have accomplished something along the lines of dealing with the terrorist threat and at the same time doing less damage to the image of the United States in the Muslim world?
Well, I think, you know, the question which was posed after 9/11 is who these guys were, and to try and cut off the flow of recruits to them. We know who these guys were. They were all allies of the United States for many years during the Cold War. They fought with them. They knew them well. Many of them were trained in the deserts of Arizona, where they simulated war in Afghanistan, and they were fought alongside the United States in Afghanistan against the Russians. That's who these guys were. Subsequently, after the Gulf War of 1990, these guys turned on the United States because they didn't like the presence of U.S. armies in the Middle East and thought that these were there to stay. That's what turned them against them. But leaving that aside, what was to be done? In my opinion, two key issues needed to be raised after 9/11. One was the sanctions against Iraq, which had led to the death of nearly 2 million people, mainly children, deprived of medicines, deprived of infrastructural necessities. These are UN figures provided by UNESCO. Now, the sanctions against Iraq should have been stopped. Iraq should have been allowed to recover, and a strong population can get rid of its own leaders. I mean, the United States waited 30 years to get for the Indonesians to get rid of Suharto, who was a much, much worse dictator than Saddam ever was. I mean, he has the deaths of millions on his hands, but because he was pro-West, he was left alone. So the lifting of sanctions in Iraq was essential, and the second thing that was crucial was to put massive pressure on Israel to pull out of the lands it had occupied after the 67 war and give the Palestinians a breathing space in their own country. That, I think, would have had a very positive impact on the world of Islam and would have led to the stop of recruits to these organizations. What the United States did was to invade Afghanistan, where Osama had its base, but the bulk of the kids who carried out the hijackings and the attacks on Twin Towers and the Pentagon came from Saudi Arabia. These were not poor Afghan peasants who carried these attacks out. They were middle-class alienated kids from Saudi Arabia. So invading Afghanistan didn't solve that particular problem. It made the Americans feel good that, you know, you'd done it, though it failed to capture Osama or most of his gang at the time. The guys who were arrested by careful police work on part of the Pakistani police force, which is how they could have been got anyway, if that was the aim. But secondly, invading Iraq and saying that Ariel Sharon was a valued ally in the war against terror, what did that lead to? That led to more terrorism. I mean, Al-Qaeda didn't exist in Iraq prior to the Iraq war. They are there now because of the U.S. presence. So they've done everything wrong from my point of view and from the point of view of most of the people who live in that world. And I think it is going to get much, much worse before it begins to get better.
We're about midway through this part of Focus 580. Let me again introduce our guest for anybody who might have tuned in. Tariq Ali, he is internationally known as political commentator. He's also a novelist, playwright. He's based in London. He is editor of the New Left Review. He's the author of more than a dozen books on world history and politics, as well as five novels. He's here visiting the campus of the University of Illinois. We'll be giving a talk about Iraq on Thursday afternoon, 4 o'clock, on the U of I campus. And just perhaps I should mention, too, that if you have seen some of the flyers around the campus, the location for the lecture is not correct. It's not what it says on the flyer. It's going to be at the Levis Faculty Center on the third floor. That's in Urbana. Same time, though, Thursday afternoon, 4 o'clock. And this is an event in the MillerCom series, and anyone who is interested in attending should feel welcome. It's open to the public and free. We have a couple of callers here to bring into the conversation. We also welcome your comments, questions. You want to pose a question to the guest, you want to agree, you want to disagree, any of that's fine. We just ask people to be brief so that we can keep the program moving, but anybody's welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And our first caller is in Charleston and line 4.
Yes. Your words of the invincibility of the U.S. war machine and their hegemony around the world, which means there are no competitors militarily. Well, I'm about to suggest that, myself being a Marxist, that the dialectical process has now removed itself from the bourgeoisie into a new generation of that element in their first stage, which means that they will have no compunction about using atomic weapons when and wherever they think at the right time they will be most effective to diminish the world population by some billions and then to try to restore the damage after the population has been eliminated. The thesis that they will arrive at this on will be with a new power group who are fewer people by that time. And I think that the left has got to recognize what is about to happen and that what we understand as terrorism, that those people who are conceived or perceived as that will never use a dirty bomb or any sort of atomic weapons, because the outcome will be that Bush or Kerry will take the atomic weapons to the Middle East. Despite the oil and all the damage that will do, they will have eradicated a part of the international community that they are now sparring with. And that that might be, I don't want to be long-winded, but nevertheless, that appears to me to be the future, because when you place invincibility upon a power group, just as the Greeks and Romans and throughout history, I don't see much that is in standing in the way to stop the present push towards the total power of U.S. influence around the world, backed up by its military. And I'll ring off and listen. Thank you, sir.
Well, Mr. Ali, what do you think?
Well, I don't agree with that, actually. I don't think that the U.S. administration at the present time or its successor is going to use nuclear weapons in the Middle East or anywhere else. I think the occasion on which they did in Japan was horrific, immoral, and a total disaster. And even though that action is defended, the aim of that action was to show future rivals like the Russians that they had the weaponry. The Japanese were the unfortunate sacrificial ram in this case. But, you know, I mean, the questioner fails to understand is that despite certain grotesque features, by and large, the American ruling elite prefers to rule indirectly. I mean, it's got people who work for it. It's preferred not to occupy countries, but to have local oligarchs who they back militarily and economically. I mean, why should they wipe out the Middle East, for God's sake? I mean, there's no basic reason to do it. Most of the elites there are collaborating with them. And wiping out the Middle East would also mean wiping out Israel, which I can't imagine any U.S. administration being prepared to do. So I'm afraid, I don't wish to be rude, but this is sort of fantasy politics. And, you enter the realm of science fiction rather than political futures. Obviously, if the American elite felt threatened, it would react very strongly. But I don't think nuclear war, either in the Middle East or elsewhere, is a serious option. I really don't. Also, what it completely fails to take into account arguments like that is that the American population is passive. Now, you know, this is not the case. You did have a big movement here, even against the Iraq war. There is still anger. The country is very polarized politically. Kerry may not be the best candidate for the anti-war movement. In fact, he isn't. But nonetheless, there's no doubt that the country is pretty polarized. And this is an interesting thing because there has been a revival of engagement in politics. Many, many young people who come to hear me in different parts of the country ask very deep and searching questions. So I'm not that pessimistic.
All right, let's go to Indiana for another caller. Line one. Hello.
Hello. I'd like for you to say a few words about Iran and Syria in relationship to what we're doing in Iraq now, and what that may forebode for the immediate future, say out to 3 to 5 years.
Well, I think that one thing which you can regard as virtually excluded is a military intervention in Syria or Iran. I do not think the United States has the capacity or the military strength, I mean on the ground, not in the air, to take Syria or Iran. And even if the politicians decided to go on a crazy adventure in that direction, I think you have very sober generals in the Pentagon who would resist, as some of them did even before Iraq, objecting, saying that this was not an intelligent operation and its aims were unclear. And the notion that with the mess in Iraq, with the Iraqi resistance attacking U.S. and other occupying forces and corporations every single day, that the United States is going to repeat that process in Syria and Iran would be utterly foolish. It would very rapidly reach overstretch proportions, and they would have to introduce the draft in the United States because people would not volunteer to join an army when they were pretty sure that joining that army would lead to death very rapidly. so they wouldn't do it. So they would have to introduce the draft, which would raise all sorts of questions within the American population as to the moral political justification for these wars. Now, what is possible and what has been discussed is whether they might use sharp surgical strikes to bomb the Iranian nuclear reactors. And I think even that's a risky operation. They might try and do it, but it'll create havoc in the region.
All right, let's go to, we have a caller here on a cell phone. This will be line number two. Hello.
Only in America could somebody come over here uninvited and give their opinion of a minority in a squeaky wheel and get away with it, and then turn around, and then you're asking money so I can listen to a program like this.
Well, this is a good quality in the United States, that it's not a dictatorship, that it listens to different views from people. It doesn't stop people coming, and you should feel proud of that, even though you disagree with me.
I disagree with you, and I think...
Of course you do, but you should feel proud of a country which doesn't yet totally curb dissent. There are many parts of the world where this can't happen. And especially
maybe one of these days I can write a little book and they'll put me on this show.
Maybe they will.
On the John Kerry show, and then I'll be able to spout my squeaky wheel stuff.
Well, you can spout whatever you want, your squeaky wheel or any other sort of wheel, but what you must understand, surely, is that your opinions, from what I can gather, are represented every single day on Fox TV, most of the print media, the bulk of the television network, so you shouldn't grudge radio shows occasionally voicing dissent.
Do you think, maybe it's the wrong thing to ask this question, but do you think that the kind of view of the United States and its foreign policy that you have laid out, that it is the most widely held view in the Middle East, in the region that we're talking about? If you look at what non-Americans think of what we have done there, do you think that you're fairly representing the way people feel?
I think I'm being very moderate, actually. If you really went to that region and did vox pops on the streets, you'd get very sharp views, much more sharper than anything I've stated today. But, I mean, you know, a few days ago I was at McAllister College in Minnesota debating this young professor of history from Harvard University, Neil Ferguson, who, of course, doesn't agree with me at all, but he agrees on the basic premises. He says that the United States is an empire, and he criticizes the United States for not invading more countries and occupying more countries. So the basic premise of what the United States is up to is now barely challenged, either from the right or the left. So this is something which is relatively new. But to come back to your question, obviously, if you went to the Arab world, you would find large numbers of people representing these views. Not the elites who have been put in power there and are backed by the United States, the sheikhs and the little sheikhdoms and the kings of Saudi Arabia and the princes and the president of Egypt. But if you talk to ordinary people, journalists, newspaper editors, people on the streets, you'd get a very hard reaction.
Let's continue. The next caller is in Monticello. This is line three. Hello.
Hi.
Yes. Line three? Hello? Caller must have changed their mind. How about we'll try Belgium? This is over by Danville, line four. Hello.
Good morning. I don't want to go along with the critical thought of this previous caller, but what I'd like to ask you is, in the geographical terms of the Mediterranean Sea, the south and the east, we'll stretch it a little bit when we talk about Iraq and Iran, but the south and the east of the Mediterranean are not democratic, where the north and the west of the Mediterranean are democratic. And large groups of people move from the south and the east towards the north and the west to get towards democracy. And they hear back from their relatives who may be going in that area, why don't they push harder for democracy themselves? The Europeans don't seem to want to push for the democracy in that particular part of the world. I don't totally understand where it's our responsibility to push for it.
Well, I mean, I don't think this is true, that people in these regions don't want democracy. Whenever they've tried to get democracy, they've been crushed. Often they've been crushed by regimes and elites backed by the United States of America. And now increasingly you hear supporters of the administration saying, well, but, you know, democracy can be paradoxical in these regions. Why? Because they might elect governments hostile to the interests of the United States. So you can't have your cake and eat it. If Egypt was given the chance, Egypt is a country totally dependent now on billions of dollars from the United States each year to keep its leaders in tow. If Egypt was permitted a democracy, would the United States be happy with the elected government? I doubt it very much. So I really challenge the view that the Arab people do not like democracy. Their leaders don't, because most of them would be voted out if democracy arrived in that region. And I think both in Iraq and Syria, you could have very interesting results if you had elections, as in Iran.
I understand that, but what I'm getting at is the Americans seem to want to dilly-dally in all these portions of the world, but yet they don't really want to help the people themselves.
Oh, I know. This is a problem. You know, the fact is the following. All these countries you're talking about, in which we know, are amongst the richest oil producers in the world. The oil they produce is of great value. It's not even that the United States needs all that oil, but they want control of it because that oil is absolutely central for their economic rivals in the Far East. And so that is what gives these countries their edge. If there was no oil in these regions, no one would be interested in them at all. It's the oil that gives them the interest, and it's much, much better from the point of view of the United States imperial leadership to have regimes in these countries which are pliable. And often the regimes which are most pliable and pliant are not elected regimes.
If I might digress just slightly, the Saudis and these countries are producing more and more oil every day, but yet the price of oil continues to go up. It seems the problem in the oil aspect is that the demand in China is going up and up and up.
Yeah. No, China's demand for oil is now, gargantuan. It's the most dynamic capitalist economy in the world. And it needs massive amounts of oil. And that helps to explain why the price has gone up. Of course, the other reason which explains the rise in oil prices is the fact that the Iraqi oil wells aren't functioning, because the resistance is blowing up the oil pipelines and saying, if we can't have it, you won't either. So Iraqi oil, which was sanctioned, but which was sold underneath the counter through various third parties and even reached the United States, is no longer available. So the United States now is forced to buy a great deal of oil from another regime it doesn't like, the Chavez regime in Venezuela. But you're right, the price of oil is high, and this will, I think, continue till the Iraqi oil wells start flowing again.
Thank you very much, sir.
All right, back to Urbana in line one. Hello.
Hello. Yes, I guess it's commentary on the opinion of the United States in the Middle East. If you read Ferguson, as you debated him, Friedman and Wolfowitz, it seems that the people of the Middle East must have been reading their writings, because they were all praising the virtues of empire. In fact, Friedman, back, when was it, in 2002, when he published that article in the Atlantic, was praising the British Empire of the 19th century and early 20th century, and the Roman Empire, if you can believe it, of the 2nd century. These people apparently read American press better than the American people.
Who are you talking about reading the American press?
The Middle Easterners. They seem to know what's going on.
Oh, sure. Yeah, no. They do it not so much because they read Friedman or Ferguson or Wolfowitz, but because they experience it very directly themselves. But these guys who are now singing the praises of the British Empire and saying that's the model the United States should follow have a very twisted and distorted view of what the British Empire was. And I often point out that when the British left India after nearly 200 years of rule, 90% of the population still lived in the countryside. 85% of the population was totally illiterate. Diseases claimed the lives of most of, you know, I think the figure is 6 out of 10 children born died because of malnutrition. Large-scale famines, many deliberately created because the grain was transferred elsewhere in the empire, led to the loss of massive lives. So the fact that this is not understood still or is ignored is deeply shocking. I mean, the British Empire is not something which should be mimicked, and nor should one forget that, the United States, the British were centrally involved in slavery. I mean, the slave trade helped strengthen British capital and merchant capital in particular. So the notion that any of these things could be repeated today is grotesque. And the fact that serious people, I mean, people who are taken seriously in this country, are spouting these views is a sign of the times. That, you know, obviously people want to listen to this guff.
There's one other point.
Mm-hmm.
While certain British industrialists and merchants made a great deal of money out of the empire, the British nation never did. It was a losing proposition the entire existence.
Absolutely. Though they, you know, like poor whites in the South, the working class in Britain for a long, long time was pretty attached to empire because they thought they got some benefits, and I think they got a tiny bit, but very tiny. I mean, the conditions of the English working classes and the Scottish working classes throughout the 19th and early 20th century were a total disaster. It wasn't till the, really, if one's being very factual, till the end of the Second World War that real reforms were pushed through and there was a redistribution of wealth which benefited the poor. But this had nothing to do with empire.
Well, I'm greatly enjoying your talk, and I have been an admirer of you for some time. Keep up the good work.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call. Let's go to Champagne. The next caller is line 2. Hello.
I'd like to agree with the previous caller that this station no longer represents anybody but the university people who run it. You hear quite a bit, one show after the next on the station, about how the administration is not just wrong but evil, and how they have malicious intent. And again and again, I mean, even the programming that they produce themselves is anti-administration. And the argument I heard from the man who has just recently gotten the job as the guy who's running the station is that you can find balance on other stations. What irks me is that the other stations don't take public money. If the public money is used for partisan jabs at our administration, then that's a misuse of the public money. And I really enjoy most of the programming on this station. But the stuff that they do, especially the stuff they produce themselves, is very obviously partisan and very obviously biased. And I don't think that it's the job of publicly funded institutions to balance commercial radio. The thing that a publicly funded institution such as WILL should be doing is providing a fair and balanced look as opposed to being so partisan. And I think this guest is one more example of how biased that this station is. I'll hang up now.
Well, if you look at most publicly funded broadcasting services in the world, and I would urge you to sort of look beyond the United States on this one, you will find the BBC, which has been under heavy pressure from the government recently. But nonetheless, on BBC Radio, you will find sometimes very sharp critiques of the Blair administration. On French public radio, you have whole programs which discuss the politics and culture of the French Republic and are often much, much sharper in their criticism of the government than anything in the United States. The same applies to Germany. And in fact, one of the aims of publicly funded television and radio broadcasting networks is that they show or provide listeners with voices from a minority, which is rarely heard. That is one of the functions. I mean, even under the Thatcher government in Britain, this is an extreme conservative government, not dissimilar to the Bush administration here. This government made available and passed a law in Parliament producing a new television channel in Britain called Channel 4. And the parliamentary remit was that the aim of this channel was exclusively to show the views of the minority, political minorities, cultural minorities, racial minorities, which it did very, very successfully for 15 years before it was partially privatized. And it is only public broadcasting channels which can actually balance the stuff which you hear on the commercial networks, because that's where money counts. That's what the money is used for. I mean, you know, you spend a lot of time attacking this radio station. I'm shocked whenever I come to the United States to see Fox TV and how unbalanced and how biased it is. But that never seems to bother people too much. It's the small space provided to dissenting views from the other side which creates panic. And, you know, it's not worth it, really, because it's good for you and it's good for the moral political health of this country. If you had the same sort of bland voices you hear every single day everywhere else, it wouldn't be very good.
Hmm. Well, let's go to at least one more caller. Chicago, this will be line number three. Hello.
Hello. I just want to say that it's really sad because one thing WILO will never have to do, and that's print an apology to its listeners, as the New York Times did, saying that it ignored the other alternative views. And I think that we should be proud of that. And I'm going to try to squeeze in my question. Mm-hmm. What's going to happen with Great Britain now that there's the demand that the U.S. needs more troops? It seems to me that the anti-war movement is increasing in Britain. I know there was at least 20,000 protesting this last weekend, and now they've kidnapped another British citizen. So do you think that the pressure is going to increase on Tony Blair if he tries to meet the U.S.'s demands?
Well, I think two-thirds of the British Army is already in Iraq, and it'll be difficult for them to send the remaining one-third there. And there's no way in which Britain could introduce the draft or conscription, because people wouldn't buy it. 56% of the British population now wants troops out of Iraq. So if Blair totally continues to defy public opinion in this way, he'll be removed from power. I mean, it's not easy to do that because there's no alternative. People will reduce or wipe out his majority, and many will vote for the Liberal Democrats. But I think that it's going to be difficult, and it's going to be even difficult for Britain to remove troops from the south and cities like Basra and send them to Baghdad to shore up the American presence there, because casualties are much, much higher in Baghdad than in Basra. And once British troops begin to come home in body bags, and at the moment I think not about 100 or 150 British soldiers have lost their lives, if this figure goes up, there will be a big, big reaction to it, and Blair's perfectly well aware of that, and so is his party.
Okay. Thank you, and thank you for your calmness. I missed a great deal of attack, and I've just enjoyed this conversation a great deal. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you for the call. I think that we're about at the point where we're going to have to finish, and my apologies, we have a couple of callers we can't take, but we're just kind of rather at the end of the time. I do, however, want to mention, though, for people who are in and around Champaign-Urbana, that if you are interested in hearing more from our guest, Tariq Ali, he will be giving a talk about Iraq, From Sanctions to Occupation and Resistance. That's a title sponsored by a number of units on the campus as part of the MillerCom series, 4 o'clock on Thursday afternoon at the Levis Faculty Center on the third floor there. That's in Urbana. And then also he'll be taking part in a panel discussion, The Future of Radical Politics. This is today at 4 o'clock in the afternoon in the Humanities Lecture Hall of the IPRH building on West Pennsylvania. And you also might look for some of his other writing. He's editor of the New Left Review. He has written more than a dozen books on world history and politics, and also 5 novels. Mr. Ali, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Talking with us. We appreciate it.